This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. In Baghdad, Saddam Hussein defiantly rejects charges that he committed atrocities during his tenure as president of Iraq. In Sierra Leone, rebel leader Augustine Bao refuses to leave his cell on the first day of his trial for war crimes, saying he does not recognize the legitimacy of the court. In The Hague, a former Croatian general pleads not guilty to war crimes at the International Criminal Tribunal, where former Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic is also standing trial for crimes committed under his leadership. All over the world, former leaders and military officers are being held accountable for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Such trials would be impossible without extensive investigations by teams of specialists who inspect mass graves and study the remains of victims, searching for evidence that will hold up in a court of law. Investigating war crimes and atrocities is the talk of the nation. If you've had any experience in these investigations or prosecutions, we'd like to hear from you. If you have thoughts on past trials that took place or that did not take place, give us a call. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us is John Sencich, a former international war crimes investigator. He led the investigation of Slobodan Milosevic for crimes alleged to have occurred in Croatia. He is now a professor of law and justice at California University of Pennsylvania and joins us from member station WDUQ in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Lynn.
Perhaps we could begin with some definitions. What exactly is meant by a war crime, and how is that different from a crime against humanity or genocide? Or can you make some of those distinctions for us?
Yes, Lynn. Well, a lot of different activities that can take place, and I think a murder is probably the best example. If one kills another individual domestically, it's an ordinary crime or a murder, and they're tried in their domestic jurisdiction. The same murder during an international armed conflict or an internal armed conflict, depending upon the circumstances, may also be a war crime, a crime against humanity, or going towards genocide. It all depends upon the degree to which or in which the murder took place. So, for example, if an individual takes a prisoner of war and executes the prisoner of war, or they attack a civilian and kill that civilian, that murder would be considered a war crime. If it was a large, widespread, and systematic attack against civilians, and it was a part of state policy, it could be considered a crime against humanity because it's gone up to that level. Or if numerous people were murdered, of course, genocide doesn't have to be only murder, but it typically is. Mm-hmm. If the intent is to eliminate in whole or part an entire population based upon their ethnic or religious background, then that could rise to the level of genocide. So it all depends upon the intent of the actor or the perpetrator.
What do you mean when you say genocide doesn't have to be murder? I thought.
Well, genocide is to eliminate that population, but it could be done through the sterilization of women. Uh-huh. Or other ways that would keep that particular population from advancing or going into the future.
Now, how are international investigations different from domestic investigations?
Well, probably the single most difference is the magnitude, how large the case is. For example, you could have a murder in the United States, and it takes a lot of effort to go towards solving that crime, although most of the crimes are solved relatively soon. But in an international case, such as in the former Yugoslavia, for example, you have to look at the number of people that have been murdered, and you have to locate witnesses, because there's two different aspects to an international war crimes investigation. There's the crime base aspect or the crime base phase and the leadership aspect. And if you're going for the crime base aspect, you have to define witnesses. Those witnesses are all around the world. Many of them have left where they originally were. They may have witnessed homicides or witnessed other war crimes, and you have to locate those witnesses. So that's mm-hmm. one aspect, is traveling really all across the globe. War crimes investigators aren't working domestically; they're traveling across the globe.
And what do you mean? You said you make a distinction between the crime-based aspect and the leadership.
Yes. Well, with an international war crimes investigation, you have to look at who is the subject of the investigation or who is going to be prosecuted. And typically, these cases are going towards the military or the political leadership. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to tie those individuals to the crime base. So the first part is looking at the crime base. How were the people killed? Was it, in fact, a homicide? Who did it? And you have to answer those questions through a lot of different investigative means. And once you determine that these people were in fact killed as part of an international or an internal armed conflict, then you have to look at, investigators have to look at, the level of the subject of the investigation, the leadership, the military and political leadership, and try to connect those individuals to the crime base. But you can't connect those individuals to the crime base without proving that in fact these war crimes or crimes against humanity indeed occurred.
Well, how do you begin to establish that it's a war crime as opposed to what might be described as a legitimate act of war? You're going into situations where war is taking place, has taken place, and many people are dying, many people are being killed. How does an investigator begin to establish this was not a legitimate act of war, this was outside of what we think of as legitimate?
Right. And it has to be, of course, outside of what you think is legitimate. Well, one way, if it's simply a war crime investigation, and I shouldn't say simply because it's not a simple case whatsoever, is to try to determine whether or not a civilian was murdered or civilians were killed. And they could have been killed incidentally or as a result of collateral damage. So the investigator has to go in and, in conducting that crime-based investigation, as I said, not only look at the fact that the person was killed, but how they were killed, under what circumstances were they killed. Because if you did have, as you said, under the auspices of a legitimate conflict, if there is such a thing, that the one side goes in and engages in combat with the enemy and civilians are close by and they're killed collaterally, as I said, then that would not be a war crime. So you have to show that they were intentionally targeted. Another war crime could be and when we're talking about murders, but war crimes go beyond that, but staying with the murders or the willful killings, the war crime might also include the execution of prisoners of war, people who have laid down their arms. They're no longer combatants, and they've been executed. So you have to look at the circumstances, not only how they died, but the circumstances under which they died.
What are some of the biggest obstacles that you face?
Finding live witnesses. Many of the witnesses are dead, so you have to, you can look at forensics, so that's one distinct aspect. But finding witnesses that were there. Sometimes we've interviewed children or relatives that were hiding, and they saw the groups come in and kill their grandparents or kill their parents, and they're able to provide testimony later. But trying to locate these individuals, and they're not necessarily there in that country any longer, so it entails traveling abroad, going into another national jurisdiction, requesting permission to go into that national jurisdiction to conduct the investigation, because that's a matter of sovereignty. You just can't go into another country and conduct a criminal investigation. And then attempting to, once you develop the evidence from the witness, attempting to persuade the witness to testify in court. And there's difficulty having witnesses testify in court in domestic jurisdictions. That same problem certainly exists, and maybe even more so, in an international war crimes investigation. And that's just dealing with witnesses to the crime base.
Yeah, and then much of the evidence, as I understand it, that you need is also found in mass graves. Is that right? May be found in mass graves.
Yes. Well, as I said, you have to be able to find or determine the manner in which the person died. Was it a homicide? And one of the first places you go to in the United States or in any national jurisdiction, and the same thing in an international war crimes, and I'm using the term war crimes generically, but it would also include crimes against humanity, is going to the crime scene. Now, you may be going there many years later and exhuming old remains that have been there for a long time that may have happened 10 years earlier, and you have to look at old autopsy reports. This is when you bring in the experts, forensic pathologists, forensic anthropologists, and they bring their expertise to the table to determine the cause of death and gathering any scientific evidence and forensic evidence that can be used circumstantially to help prove which perpetrator group, who killed these people, and then, as I said earlier, begin the long step or the long task of attempting to link the individuals at the leadership in the political and military organizations to the responsibility for those homicides or for those rapes or whatever crimes they may have occurred, because it could also include torture, forced deportations, what we would commonly refer to as ethnic cleansing. So the crimes are not only homicides, but when you have so many crimes that have taken place, it seems that, and because of the seriousness of the life of a human being, that an emphasis is certainly placed on the homicide aspects of war crimes investigations.
We are talking about investigating war crimes. If you would like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-TALK. I'd like to take a call now from Tony, who's in Cleveland. Hi, Tony. Tony?
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I'd just like to add a comment, particular point out the case in Bosnia. You mentioned the evidence. I think, you know, ever since the war crime tribunal started against various military figures and political figures in Bosnia, the evidence has been there. When they do eventually catch Karadzic and Mladic, I guess just my question or comment would be, why is the international community unwilling to go after these two figures? To me, you know, they've made attempts to get them, but it just seems like a token measures.
Mr. Senchert?
Yes. Well, I think that there is a serious international effort to locate these individuals. Their particular whereabouts, at least to my knowledge, are not known. It's suspected where they may be. And it's also my understanding that political pressure is coming upon certain groups to apprehend them and have them transferred to The Hague. I don't have any personal knowledge of the specific negotiations that are going on in that regard, but I do know that it's taking place as we speak, and the international community, the prosecutor, and the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia are working with many governments trying to bring these individuals to justice. I can assure you that they are putting forth a strong effort.
All right. Thanks for your call, Tony.
Thank you.
That makes me wonder about the sort of the politics of this. I mean, I would imagine as an investigator, you have to try to the best of your ability to stay outside. These things are surrounded by huge politics. How do you divorce yourself from that?
Well, that's a really good question, Lynn, and I was thinking about that as I was driving here today. Well, what comes up? Well, how do I handle a political question? Because really, as a war crimes investigator, when we go in, we don't look at the politics of it at all. It doesn't really matter which perpetrator group committed the crime or which ethnic group the victims were involved with. If somebody has murdered, and particularly in Yugoslavia, I investigated one ethnic group that murdered another ethnic group, or members of one ethnic group murdering members of another, and then members of the group that had been victims now turning and being perpetrators against the other group. And as an investigator, it didn't make any difference. We were there to investigate the crimes that took place, look at the victims as victims, and look at the perpetrators as perpetrators, and try to keep those politics out, because that's the thing about a modern war crimes investigation. We're bringing modern criminal investigation into the courtroom the way that we would do it here in a national jurisdiction, and replicating that in an international forum.
All right. We are talking about what it's like on the inside of an international war crimes investigation. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. And you can send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about what goes on during the investigations of war crimes and crimes against humanity. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. My guest is John Senchitz. He's a former international war crimes investigator. And one specialized area in these kinds of investigations is what's called forensic anthropology. It's a relatively new science that identifies the dead on the basis of their bones. Joining us to talk about this line of work is Mimi Duretti, an expert in forensic science and co-founder of the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team. She's with us on the phone from her office in Brooklyn, New York. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Can you really explain the science of forensic anthropology for us first?
Yes, well, basically, forensic anthropology works when we have to analyze skeletal remains. And it's often, in other words, when the body has lost its soft tissue, and even though forensic pathology still, of course, has a lot of work to do with skeletal remains, it often works with the support of forensic anthropologists who specialize more into the analysis of bones. And basically what we try to do is two things. We try to identify the remains based on the evidence that we found on the bones, and we try to provide information about the cause and the manner of death. Cause being what exactly the person died of, for example, a gunshot wound, and the manner, which is what you were talking partly before on the interview, which is how this happened. For example, if it's a gunshot wound, was this an accident, was this a homicide, or was this a suicide?
And how would you make the how as a forensic anthropologist could you make those kinds of distinctions, those kinds of decisions?
Well, we mostly work on providing information about the cause of death. Yeah, based on what we call the perimortem trauma, that is to say, trauma that occurred around the moment of death that we can find that we may find in the bones. For example, such as a gunshot wound to the head. Now that not necessarily may provide us much information about the manner of death, though sometimes when we, for example, when reconstructing the trajectory of a bullet, and we see a pattern, for example, of 10 individuals all with entrance of gunshot wounds in the back of their heads, then in that case, that information most likely suggests a homicide other than an accident or a suicide.
Now, you are from Argentina, and you began this kind of work in your home country. Is that correct?
Right.
Can you tell me how you got involved in it and what kind of work you did in Argentina first?
I'm part of a team, and we started working with Dr. Clyde Snow, an American forensic anthropologist that came to Argentina to help on the identification of the people who disappeared during the last military government that ruled our country between 76 and 83. And approximately 10,000 people disappeared, and their remains needed to be found and analyzed and returned to the families and bring the evidence to the courts. There was no precedent of doing this in my country and in many others as well. And so we initially started assisting Dr. Snow doing this work, and then later we formed the team and start working in other places as well.
This is really, I'm trying to even begin to understand how you did this, because just the term itself disappeared means people didn't know where these people had gone to. So how did this work begin? How did you recover the bodies and begin to identify them?
Yeah, that I guess is what it's quite different when you're working with an international tribunal such as the one in The Hague, in ICTY, which we did work also for several years for them, then when you work on this other context, a much smaller scale kind of investigation, and basically having to investigate your own state. So in those contexts, the work of forensic anthropology goes normally to a much longer extent than what we normally should, and we do a lot of what we call preliminary investigation, which basically involves all the investigation that normally a detective will do. Interviewing witnesses, interviewing survivors of illegal detention centers in Argentina, for example, that last saw a person go into the cemetery records, try to see if there are signs of people being buried as John or Jendo, brought by the police or the militaries, look at autopsy reports, and interview families and so on, so that to have to start working on where the bodies may have been, and from there try to go narrow them to individuals.
How difficult is this work psychologically and emotionally, particularly when you're doing it in your own country, I would think it would be?
Well, it goes both ways, I guess. In one way, one feels useful on doing a very concrete work, and it's rewarding when you see that what it can do for the families that are waiting for those remains for years, and also when you can reach a court and present this evidence there. However, of course, it is also very sad often, and not very easy to deal with it. But at the same time, when we started working on this, we the ones who stayed, I guess we realized that when we were doing the work, we were okay. We were able to do it. Afterwards, it's a different thing. Hmm. But while you're doing it, you're just very concentrated on doing everything right, all the technical aspects that are implied.
We are talking about the business of investigating war crimes and crimes against humanity. If you have any questions for our guests, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. We're going to take a call now from James. He's calling from Virginia. Hi, James.
Hi. My question is for the legal expert. I understand there are various treaties like the Geneva Convention and like for the International Criminal Court. But my question is, what would happen if there was a country where they had not signed these international conventions and somebody in that country did some atrocities? Would those people be able to be prosecuted in an international setting or an international tribunal, or is there no jurisdiction to, like, go into the sovereignty of, like, a country that has decided not to become an international signatory?
John Sanchez, could you take that question, please? And thanks so much for your call, James.
Yes, thanks for the question there, James. There are a lot of different ways that a prosecution, such as what you have laid out, could be undertaken. The UN Security Council, for example, could authorize the creation of an international war crimes tribunal specifically for that combat or for that particular conflict. So that's one way. That's what happened in Yugoslavia and Rwanda by the UN Security Council. Another way could be that a national jurisdiction prosecutes the perpetrators of the crime. For example, many national jurisdictions have passed legislation, the United States included, that if people are U.S. citizens or permanent residents of the United States and they're living in this country and they are suspected of having committed a war crime, they can be prosecuted although the crime didn't occur here in the United States. That's called extraterritorial jurisdiction or the exercise of extraterritorial jurisdiction. Other crimes are that are similar to this are crimes of universal jurisdiction where any country could come in. And Belgium is one, Spain is another, that are known for prosecuting individuals for having committed crimes in third countries that they were not involved in. So there are ways to prosecute these people. It just depends upon the particular strategy. Iraq, for example, a special statute was passed in Iraq to prosecute Saddam Hussein and other perpetrators of alleged war crimes in Iraq or in Iran and other countries. And that's being done nationally in Iraq, but the crimes are really international crimes, although they have been codified or incorporated into special national legislation.
We've been talking about the often difficult and complicated process of conducting an investigation into international war crimes. Once all the evidence and supporting documents are ready, the case goes to trial. And as in all trials, there's a prosecutor and a defense attorney. Joining us now from The Hague in the Netherlands is an international criminal attorney who has represented a number of leaders accused of committing war crimes. Right now, he's involved in the ongoing trial of former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. He is Misha Vladimirov. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
What's involved in preparing for the defense in a war crime trial such as what we've been discussing here?
Well, one has to keep in mind that you are not dealing with a case within your own jurisdiction. So the usual network of all facilities being available are not there. Actually, what you face in most of these cases before these kind of ad hoc or permanent international tribunals is that you have to go abroad. You have to do your research outside your own country where you're not sure that these states will cooperate. And in most cases, for example, in the former Yugoslavia, you will find that those states are not very eager to cooperate because their officials might be involved. So therefore, it's extremely difficult to do your job in the proper way.
Now, is it difficult to personally defend someone accused of committing war crimes or atrocities? I mean, how do you deal with that, the emotional aspect of this for yourself?
Sure. When I took my first case before the Yugoslavia tribunal, the ICTY, actually, it was the first case before that tribunal, the case of Duško Tadić. I was about 25 years in the bar. And according to the continental European experience, you're not quite interested in, let's say, choosing your case, whether you win or not. It is a matter of being an officer of the court and to afford the accused the best possible defense. So you're not emotionally involved because what he did is a matter for the prosecution and for the court, and your task simply is, as I said, to afford him the best possible defense, period.
Now, I know that in one trial or in the pre-trial part of it, and I thought it was in the trial of Slobodan Milosevic, but it may have been Duško Tadić. You can correct me, tell me which one it is, that you actually challenged the legality of the tribunal as a first step. I wonder if you can explain why you did that and which trial it was in. And
Right. Actually, that was in the first trial, which was the obvious question to put forward, because...
And the first trial was the Duško Tadić trial?
That's right. It was the trial of Duško Tadić. And I challenged, indeed, the validity of the establishment of the tribunal established by the Security Council. And the remarkable thing was that the trial chamber, by majority, ruled that they were competent to deal with the matter, though in majority they had a different view, one of the judges. And in appeals, they took a totally different view, but actually their view was indeed again that they were competent, but the reasoning was totally different, and it shows that this was really a valid argument, although the argument was not accepted.
Hmm. Now, you were also involved in the UN tribunal in Rwanda, is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Now, was it very different in that situation, or pretty much the same rules apply, and you just...
Well, actually, we had the benefit of the case law of the Yugoslavia tribunal before the Rwanda tribunal started. The conditions before the ICTR, the Rwanda tribunal, are very poor compared to the ICTY, the Yugoslavia tribunal, keeping in mind that if you do your discovery on location, you have to go to Rwanda itself. That's what I did. And there you will find that there are no facilities whatsoever to find your witnesses, to interview them, to bring them to the tribunal in another state, which was, in that case, Tanzania, where the tribunal is based. So actually, what you will find is, within Europe, at the end of the day, it's all worked. But in Africa, it was totally different because Rwanda did not want to cooperate with that tribunal in a foreign state. They actually had a preference for the tribunal being in Rwanda. So that was extremely difficult.
Well, I appreciate your joining us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Misha Vladimirov is an international criminal attorney who has represented people accused of committing war crimes. He's currently participating in the trial of Slobodan Milosevic, and he spoke to us from The Hague in Netherlands. We're going to try and take another call now. We have Miroslav in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I would like to ask your guys why they never tried to put it in the trial, Mr. Tudjman and Mr. Izetbegovic, for their war crimes, because they did many war crimes against Serbs, and they let them die natural causes instead of bringing them to the Hague. So I would like to know why.
John Sanchez, do you have an answer to that?
Well, I can give the best answer that I can.
And maybe you could explain for those who don't know who these people are. Maybe you can give us a little background, a little context here.
I had a little difficulty understanding the caller, but I did hear the name of Mr. Tudjman, who was the former president of Croatia. And his comment was that the Serbs were victims of war crimes as well. Well, Serbs were victims of war crimes, undoubtedly. I mean, there have been indictments, there have been prosecutions in the former Yugoslavia. Muslims, or Bosnian Muslims, Serbs, and Croats were all victims, and all three groups were also perpetrators. But my position was not at a political level. I was an investigator. What might have happened, I think that the caller might want to do a little bit of research. I don't want to speak on something that I'm not able to do, but a little bit of research may show that something may have happened to Mr. Tudjman had he not died while an investigation was ongoing. But so why it hadn't been done any earlier than that, I'm really not in a position to discuss. But he is indeed correct that Serbs were victims of war crimes, as were all the groups in the former Yugoslavia.
Thanks so much for your call, Miroslav. And I have an email here that perhaps either Mima Doretti or John Sanchez, so either one of you might have an answer to this. How can I perform volunteer work in this field, or how would I enter this as a career? Mimi?
We actually work with a lot of volunteers in our team, and all Latin American teams do the same kind of work too as well. You can write to any of us an email. I don't know if we can pass the email afterwards.
All right, maybe perhaps we can put a link up on our website. Something.
So normally you can't work. We cannot use volunteers to work on cases that will be prosecuted because of the obvious legal complications for that.
John Sanchez, do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I do know that there are a lot of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, such as Human Rights Watch, that are out there that may very well be looking for volunteers or to take on additional staff members, because these NGOs do provide an awful lot of assistance for international war crimes investigations. I mean, they're not out there.
If both of you will stay with us for a little bit, we're going to try and see if we can get a couple more calls in after we take a short break. Thanks so much. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, join guest host Joe Palca for a look at money, research, and conflict of interest at the National Institutes of Health. Right now we are talking about war crimes investigations. My guests are John Sentich, a former international war crimes investigator, and Mimi Doretti, an anthropologist who works in forensic science and co-founder of the Argentine Forensic Anthropology. We are going to take a call now from Merrick, who's in Hartford, Connecticut. Merrick, go ahead.
Lynn, thanks for having me on.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to call in and share my experience. I was one of the U.S. peacekeepers on the ground in Bosnia for 6 months from 1998 to 99. I was one of the JAGs there. And one of the things that we would do as we were working on elections, crimes, and whatnot was obviously try to kick up any evidence we could and any location of any of these folks in Bosnia. I specifically remember one day when we were out in the Serb what is called Serb Sarajevo. It's a town called Pale, just outside of Sarajevo, where Radovan Karadzic and others who were accused of war crimes were located. And when you try to find these folks, it was brutally difficult to kick up any initial leads about them, in large part because the local population had, quite frankly, been very supportive of them, had engaged in a lot of ethnic cleansing, and was harboring a lot of these war criminals.
Is this something that you've run into, John Senchitz? I know that you've interviewed witnesses in these cases.
Well, yes, I'm very familiar with the efforts of NATO, the NATO-led peacekeeping force, S4, in Bosnia, who put forth an incredible effort to locate and to apprehend, working in conjunction with the Hague Tribunal, to apprehend the war crimes suspects or the indictees. I have found that certainly there are some that are harboring these individuals and that are obstructive in the investigation, but I've also found many more individuals from Bosnia, whether they were Serbs or Croats or Bosnian Muslims, that are very cooperative, although they may have even been involved in the criminal activity at the time. Many of these people have been approached. They are cultivated as inside sources. They become cooperating witnesses, and this is one of the very unique aspects of international war crimes investigations. We work informants in national jurisdictions, but working them in an international perspective is an incredible, enormous task.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Merrick.
Thank you, Lynn.
And Mimi Doretti, let me pose this question to you, which comes from an email. How does one cope with emotions when doing this type of work, and how do you keep your personal opinions out of the investigations?
Well, it helps a lot, I think, to work, to be part of a team, to not do this work only on your own. Particularly in our team, we've been for 20 years working together, and so, you know, we help each other whenever any of us may feel that it's what we're finding, it's overwhelming. And then, frankly, for the second part of the question is, it is very, one, it's surprise about how when you are working on a case, you're really trying to be very concentrated on analyzing the physical evidence and seeing if it is consistent or not with the different versions that the investigators have collected from witnesses and survivors. And you're just very concentrated on that. So, frankly, it's not that one doesn't have a personal opinion, but if it's not within what you can prove in a way, it's part of what you can talk about at night, but it's not part of definitely not part of your report or what you take into account.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Mimi.
You're welcome.
Mimi Doretti is a forensic anthropologist and co-founder of the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team. Thanks also to John Senchitz. He's a former international war crimes investigator, now a professor of law and justice at California University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much, Mr. Senchitz, for being with us.
Thank you.